all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or at the web. VeteransRadio.org is our new URL, VeteransRadio.org. Where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.org. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to nvbdc.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at LegalHelpForVeterans.com. If you've been paying any attention at all, really, to the news, you've been hearing about how drone warfare is changing, how the Ukrainians and the Russians are both using drones to advance their military purposes. Well, this has come a long way in a short period of time. We've done programs when drones first came out, and the U.S. was the only one who had them. And they were deploying them for intelligence and then ultimately for offensive weaponry. So we've got an expert on who's going to talk about the status of drone warfare, what he calls drones 2.0. Very interesting. And then we're going to reach back into a little history. It's that time. We should talk about the Montford Point Marines of America. They have a The association has an upcoming gala, but let's get a little history going, too. So we're going to start with the modern and go back to the history. I think you're going to enjoy it. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today James Patton Rogers. I should say Dr. Rogers, actually. He holds a PhD on the history of the precision warfare from the University of Hull in the United Kingdom. He's been a fellow at Stanford University, Yale University, the University of Oxford. He was a visiting scholar at the United States Air Force Air Command and Staff College. And with all that expertise, we have him on today to talk about how drones, if you will, have evolved in warfare. And really, we're seeing them applied here in Ukraine. And James just reminded me or told me that don't forget there was something similar in Vietnam. James, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Well, as I say, you're an expert in sort of a unique area, and you've recently issued a new book called Precision, A History of American Warfare, being published by Manchester University Press here in 2023. But as you've looked at and been studying and watching what's been going on in Ukraine with Russia drones and the Ukrainian drones, Give us some insight of how you see this has evolved for the use of this sort of unmanned vehicle platform.
I think that when it comes to specifically Russia's offensive war against Ukraine, we've seen that Ukraine harnessed drones very early on as a way to try and hold Putin's forces back from taking the capital of Kiev in those very early days, early weeks of the war. We know that Turkey sent over their Bayraktar TB2s. These are medium altitude, long endurance systems that you would be more familiar with perhaps as a bit like the US Predators and Reapers that we know the US used during the global war on terror, although they're slightly different systems, but they fulfill a similar role of being sent up into the air to conduct precision strikes against targets on the ground, and also to provide that vital intelligence, surveillance, and target acquisition for other systems that Ukraine possessed. Now, that started to change very quickly as Russia brought in their own air defense systems and their electronic jamming. And what you've seen ever since then, really, is this cat and mouse game, this offensive, defensive game between Russia and Ukraine about who can innovate their drones faster and who can break through each other's defenses. And one way that Ukraine has tried to keep up with their drone innovation is not only to get supplies brought in from the international commercial market, so they bought up around 60% of the world supply of DJI-produced Mavic drones, different types of Mavic drones. These are the smaller quadcopter systems, so far different to the much larger medium long endurance, but also to develop their own drone industry and to invest millions, if not billions, into that to create tactical battlefield drones that help with their fight in the trenches on the front line.
And it seems like, back, I think the last time I had somebody on talking about drones was right at the start of their use in Afghanistan. It was all intelligence gathering, but it's really changed since then, hasn't it?
I think that when we look back to especially the Obama administration and that administration's reliance on the use of drones, then we can characterize that period as what we call the first drone age. The first nation, the United States, to really take on drones as a spearhead of pushing their military force around the world. And this was all part of Obama's promise to the American people that he would remove them from the illegal war, as it was being called, in Iraq, and win the good war in Afghanistan. And sadly, we know how that all turned out. But it was also part of reducing the cost to American military lives, as at that point, when Obama was getting elected, you had 60% of U.S. military casualties occurring as a result of the improvised explosive device. And so as the war and terror spread globally, you wanted to reduce the footprint of American military personnel abroad, not increase it. And so the drone became this panacea for the Obama administration to continue to hunt down, to find terrorists, to provide intelligence on terrorist organizations, and to kill terrorists when needed all around the world. So that's Somalia, Yemen, there were strikes even in the Philippines. We know, of course, about Afghanistan and Pakistan and a number of other countries where drones were deployed. But this was a period where it was the United States and core allies such as Great Britain and France who were provided high-tech U.S. systems. Very few other nations were allowed to have these high-tech drones. The world has changed dramatically since that time. We live in a time now that I call the second drone age. And here, and I've been working at this with the United Nations recently, we've come to the conclusion that around 113 different nation states and at least 65 non-state actors now have access to weaponized drones all around the world. We're pretty much at the point where we have the uncontrolled proliferation of military drone systems. Now, some of these have been deliberately proliferated by hostile nation states, such as Iran, who provide groups to the so-called Axis of Resistance across the Middle East, a number of different actors, including Houthi terrorists, who then use those drone systems to either recast them and make their own local drone industry and to tap into the global commercial market of drones and different commercial systems to then make those drone designs work for themselves. Or they simply use the Iranian design systems to do Iran's bidding for them. And we've seen this with attacks in the Red Sea recently, with major impact on international shipping. And so we live in a dramatically different world, a world of proliferated drone threats, where when I do my interviews with military personnel from the United States and from our allies, we've reached a point where we've lost that tactical air superiority. And we have, for the first time in maybe two generations now, this very potent, increasingly lethal and powerful threat from the air against U.S. military lives and the lives of U.S. allies. And we saw that most tragically and most recently with the death of three U.S. military personnel at Tower 22.
It is really amazing how, and to me at least, how quickly the world caught up on this. And we're talking to Dr. James Patton Rogers. He's the executive director of the Cornell Brooks Tech Policy Institute at Cornell University. Is it because the hardware became so available around the world, or the software became so available? How did this explode so fast?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I would say it's a combination of the innovations in commercial drone technologies. So let's pick up that point first. We, of course, know that these have been used en masse. The think tank in the UK, the Royal United Service Institute, says that Ukraine is losing up to 10,000 of these commercial drones each month. And it's these systems that have been designed by a number of different commercial drone manufacturers to make it easy for even simpletons like me to get their drone license and to use these sort of systems. Yeah. And for them to be used by, real estate agents, wedding photographers, agriculture, you know, all of these different drone systems have been incredibly useful for different industries. The trouble is that those technologies are also dual use. And when taken up by militaries or terrorist groups, they can be put to nefarious ends. So let's think about ISIS. ISIS were the first terrorist group to be able to link into this commercial drone market, smuggling thousands of drones over the border, buying them up through shell companies around the world. I'm talking about shell companies in Britain, in Spain, in Sri Lanka, and in Denmark, actually, and smuggling them over across the border so that they could work on their drones and create an effective ISIS drone force or an air force for ISIS. And they would use these en masse against US and allied forces during Operation Inherent Resolve. I mean, when I was conducting my research back then, you know, as many as 83 drones in the sky within a 24-hour period. And if anything, it's only got worse since then, because drone companies have made their drones much more high-tech. They can fly further, they can shift frequencies, they can carry heavier payloads. And now these drones, of course, are being utilized by a number of different terrorist groups around the world.
Let me have you expand on that, because this idea that you can have an army of drones up in the air at the same time, networked and operating in concert, is sort of an amazing thing to think about. And if you're a military planner and you got to defend against it, it's got to be quite harrowing to think about these networked armies of drones. And that's, I think they've been used in the Ukraine-Russian conflict.
Yeah, so there's a kind of a technical definition of what we might call this network of drones in the sky. This would be a true drone swarm. And any engineer that's listening, or any computer scientist that's listening, will know that we're not quite there yet in terms of a true drone swarm. This is, you know, think of a flock of birds in the sky, like a murmuration of starlings that are being attacked by an eagle, let's say. They will work together all at once to move in synchronization to make sure they keep together as that giant flock to increase their security. They communicate with one another, and they become almost one symbiotic life form in the sky. Now, we've not reached the point where we have individual drones that have that sort of connectivity and the ability to react to external stimuli. We will do, and the US is investing very heavily in that, and that's deeply worrying as well into the future, because China's doing the same. And so we will have drone v drone swarms and likely thousands of drones in the sky above zones of active conflict. What we have at the moment is we have these more rudimentary drone swarms, where drones are sent in their multiples. So these are multi-drone deployments, tens, maybe 20s max, at a target to saturate their enemy's air defense systems, or to use up their enemy's air defense systems, so that when they then do send other systems in, maybe rockets or missiles, they will have more chance of breaking through and hitting the target. And so when I mentioned the fact that ISIS had these multiple drone drone systems in the sky. You know, we're looking at maybe 10 at a time, but 83 over that 24-hour period. And as I say, it's all about trying to overwhelm air defenses.
Interesting. Yeah, I like this concept you're outlining of sort of the first drone age, the second drone age. You've clearly thought about what the third or the fourth drone age might look like. Give us, from your expert viewpoint, Dr. Rogers, where does the next drone age take us?
Well, I've just written a piece on this called the Third Drone Age, Visions Out to 2040. I think that some of the things we're looking for here, and I should also recognize the fact that we've just been funded by NATO SVS to work on this idea of full spectrum drone warfare and what threats might occur from the use of drones, not only in the air, but also on the ground, at sea, under the surface of the water, and also underground. And so we're looking at this multi-domain drone use, this full-spectrum drone use. And I think this is one of the things that's going to characterize the third drone age. Now, let's couple that with the fact that it's not just going to be those systems being controlled by human operators. Instead, you're going to have the human on the loop of control or completely outside the loop of control of these systems. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean that you can have these drones operating autonomously, picking out targets, and then sending that target data back to a human pilot or a human operator who might be controlling, let's say, 10, 20, or 100 of these systems at different points around the active zone of conflict. And then that operator will decide whether or not the data it's getting from the drone is correct and can approve that strike. Now, the next level of that, the outside the loop of control, is the one that I think that we're reaching very quickly. And this is the one where the drone system, be it used at sea, underwater, in the air, on the ground, or indeed underground, is able to choose off a preset list of targets built within its algorithm. So it's able to identify certain targets and then choose to take that strike on the target without the human being in the loop of control. So we're delegating, we're moving, we're placing into the hands of machines, into the minds of machines, that decision about whether or not another human lives or dies. We're delegating death to robots and machines, and this is the future of war. This is what is going to define the third drone age.
Well, you're scaring the hell out of me, so that's why guys like you have to think about this, so guys like me don't have to. You keep referring to drones in the sea, on the ground, and underground, and I'm only thinking about drones in the air. What am I not thinking about in terms of drones in the sea, ground, and underground?
Well, you think of the ability of the drone in the third dimension, that is the sky, the ability to move quite freely at different altitudes, to evade air defense systems, and to take out targets. So let's think about that in the third dimension, that is the water, the sea, the ocean. And you start to see how they become harder to detect, harder to track, and can be used autonomously to monitor, gather intelligence, surveillance, and to take strikes on naval targets, or perhaps, you know, lo and behold, undersea pipelines or vital interconnected wires that connect the internet around the world. We have a lot of very sensitive infrastructure under the sea, and it's those sort of systems that can be used to defend that infrastructure, but also to attack it. Now, on the surface of the water, this has become one of the latest major innovations of the war in Ukraine, and this is the use of drone boats to take out Russian military shipping. And we've seen this happen, the sinking of these ships from these comparatively much, much cheaper drone boat systems. Now, that's just the maritime domain. Let's talk about on the ground. We've seen that drones are being introduced to medevac, to be able to place people on these drone stretchers that have tank tracks so they can just take them straight off the battlefield as quickly as possible. We're also looking at these remote-controlled tank systems that can be sent underneath other tanks or sent under armored vehicles and explode underneath them. That's something that's been around since the Cold War, if not actually the Second World War. There might have been experimentation with those sort of remote control systems in the First World War. So that's not a new innovation, but it's something we're certainly seeing being put to use. And then underground, I only mention that because that's something we've seen with the war between Israel and Gaza, the war between Israel and Hamas. What we've seen there is the use of Israeli drones to be sent underground. These are drones that were designed initially for mining operations or perhaps for humanitarian release operations, to go and to survey those tunnels to make sure there's no hostiles down there, and to collect that surveillance and intelligence for Israeli forces. So we really are seeing drones being used in every facet of war. And this is why the British government today, the Defence Minister, has announced £4.5 billion. So that's well over $5 billion investment in the innovation of drones for the Royal Navy, the Royal Air Force, and the British Army.
Wow.
We'll see if that happens, or if it's just an election pledge in an election year to try and grant, which I suspect it probably is. But either way, the attention and the intent is there from a number of nations around the world that the future of war is drone war.
I've got two more areas I want to cover before we run out of time, but I want to back up. You mentioned you recently wrote on the third drone age. Can you identify where that's at? Because I think there's probably veteran radio listeners who are going, hey, Dr. Rogers has really thought about this. I want to know more. So where might we find such an article?
Well, I do mention it in the final chapters of my new book, Precision, A History of American Warfare. And if you go to Manchester University Press and if you use the code WARFARE30, you can get 30% off, and that takes it down to about $20.
Fantastic.
You can also buy the book online for the same price. It's about $20. But you can find that particular article for free online under the CIGI Institute. If you just, to be fair, if you just type in the third drone age into Google, I think I might be the only person that's written on it so far. So
you may have. I hope you coined it because it's gonna stick. Now, the two other things I want to touch on is drone defense, right? So you've just outlined an incredible new area of warfare, but there's always, you know, everything's got a reaction to the action, right? So how is drone defense developing?
Slowly, and at a pace that concerns me. It's something that I've been warning about for a long time now. Before, I've been working on drones now for well over 10 years. And it was a warning sign that we put out because we were worried about ISIS, because we were worried about the earlier Houthi attacks from 2018-2019 onwards. And the key thing and the key fact is that actually when it comes to the US, its allies, and Western militaries more broadly, there's just been a neglect of air defense for two generations. I mean, you look at the official statistics, officially, the last member of the U.S. military that was killed by hostile enemy air power was in the Korean War in 1953. And so when it comes to investing in air defense systems for such attacks, there isn't the impetus to put the money into it because there really wasn't the threat. What we were warning about was that this threat is returning. You look at the conflicts in which the U.S. has been fighting in, it's usually, if not completely, comprehensively had command of the air.
Yeah.
The only time if you want air defense is perhaps to, you know, pot shot some rockets, or maybe, you know, most importantly, and where the money has been, is to stop intercontinental ballistic missiles, to make sure you've got a really potent and powerful nuclear deterrence capability and air defense to make sure you can stop any incoming nuclear attacks. When it comes down to trying to target smaller systems and varied systems that are flown in deliberately to evade current technologies of radar. So they're flown in low, they're flown in slow, they have a smaller electronic signature. All of this is deliberately designed to evade the latest technologies of high-tech radar. When you've got an enemy that's clever enough to do that and can innovate in a low-tech way to get around your defenses, it's going to take some time to catch up in terms of air defense. And so that's what's happening right now. And you can see some big-ticket items put into place, like, you know, high-intensity lasers. A lot of money is being invested in that to literally burn drones out of the sky, and to make sure you've got this endless amount of munitions, this capacity to take the drones out. But it comes down really to a layered defense system, and to try and detect these drones before they attack your ships, before they attack your sites. And sadly, that's just something that didn't happen with the latest attacks on Tower 22. What we think happened there was a Reaper drone, I think it was, a US Reaper drone that was returning back to that base. The hostile drone was sent to follow that in, perhaps right, mimic its signature, and then to breach those air defenses. So a lot still to be done in terms of air defense.
Well, one last area I'd like to touch on, and that is there isn't a lot of ethics in war, but are people out there, maybe it's the United Nations, maybe it's NATO, maybe it's somebody else, is there an effort being put at to think about, okay, as these advances occur, is there some set of ethics that ought to apply?
I certainly think so, and this is something I've been working with the United Nations Security Council and previously the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Summary and Arbitrary Executions to try and develop such guidelines. For me, some of the most concerning issues are how, as drones are proliferating to a number of states with perhaps not the best human rights record, those drones are being used to target civilians in brutal civil wars. These nation states are finding it suspiciously difficult to differentiate between certain ethnic groups that perhaps are involved in a broader civil war and those who are active combatants. And I'd point to any of your listeners out there to recent events that have been happening in the DR Congo, in Burkina Faso, and in Nigeria. Deeply concerning attacks there, hundreds of civilian casualties. And then when it comes down to the future of drone warfare, I'm sure that your listeners will agree that the process of delegating that decision about whether or not a human lives or dies to a machine is something that should never be allowed to happen. And this is something that President Biden and President Xi say that they agree on, that China and the US are working towards this, but then at the same time, they're both developing these systems as well. And there's a lot of talks happening at the UN, and one of the first resolutions to work on a resolution, so nothing solid, was passed just at the turn of the new year to try and work on these issues. And I just hope that that the policy can keep up with the technical developments.
Well, we really appreciate your expertise and spending some time today with the veteran radio listeners, Dr. James Padden Rogers, Executive Director of the Cornell Brooks Tech Policy Institute at Cornell University. You've really run us around the whole world here on what's going on in drone technology, and as we move from the first to the second drone age and on to the third, is pretty scary. So we're glad guys like you are out there thinking about this and working with folks such as the United Nations Security Council to come up maybe with some appropriate protocols. And we didn't even use the word artificial intelligence, but that's another whole scary wrap of if these drones start making all their decisions with AI, as you say, with no human involvement, boy, oh boy, we're really heading into uncharted waters.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And thank you for having me on, and thank you for your service.
You got it, James. Thank you. Always good to get a viewpoint from an expert, and this drone technology and how it impacts national security and warfare is just pretty astounding. We've seen all kinds of different aspects of this. We saw it when Israel was attacked with some 300 drones. At the moment, the defenses are pretty good, knocked, I think, 98% of those out of the air. But, technology keeps advancing. And as I said, we didn't really even talk about the more scary aspect of it when you have artificial intelligence making the decision whether or not to send a missile and have a strike. So hope that opened your eyes a little bit and made you think a little bit. What we want to do is come back after a couple of announcements from our sponsors and talk about an upcoming national event that is occurring in the Metro Detroit area on behalf of the Montford Point Marines, and you'll get a little history about who they are and why this is worth commemorating.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit VeteransCrisisLine.net. VeteransCrisisLine.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We also want to thank the Vietnam Veterans of America National Organization for its support of Veterans Radio over the years. So now we're going to talk a little bit about the Montford Point Marines of America. You know, it's one of those stories that gets lost over time, but it's so important, and history is slipping away. A gentleman by the name of Butler Martin, he was 101 years old, died recently, and is thought to be maybe one of the last Montford Point Marines still alive in the country. So we're going to talk to the Commandant Robert Middleton of the Montford Point Marines of America, which is a organization to keep this history alive, and they have an upcoming event he's going to talk about. So again, one of those slices of history you're only going to hear on Veterans Radio, and that's why your support is so important. You can go to veteransradio.org and contribute there. You can look up, us up on Facebook and find a way to send us a few dollars in that direction. And certainly if you're a business owner and you think, hey, this is my audience, this group of patriots and veterans is my audience, contact us. We'd glad to set up something special for you as a commercial sponsor. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Robert B. Middleton II, the National Commandant of the Montford Point Marines of America. Robert, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, it's an honor and a privilege. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, this is an interesting group to talk about, and it's got an upcoming military banquet and award ceremony on June 23rd of 2024. It'll be held at Burden Manor in Livonia, Michigan. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. But let's start with a little bit about you. You spent 5 years in the Marine Corps and then went on to a quite incredible finance and business consulting career. Give us a thumbnail sketch of your background just so everybody can kind of go, oh man, I can relate to that guy.
Oh, bless your heart. Well, let's see. I was in the United States Marine Corps, 5 years altogether, 3 years active, 2 years in the National Guard. I served during the Vietnam era. I served in the Republic of Vietnam, 68-69, where I conducted, I was with the Fort Air Command. I was in the Fixed Wing Unit, Fort Air Command, where I coordinated fixed wing airstrikes on enemy targets near the DMZ. And so I'm proud of that, that heritage and that background with the United States Marine Corps. After that, I came back to the United States. I attended the University of Michigan. I majored in political science, public policy, and administration. Got a background in economics as well and business law. I went on to form a successful consulting company with a background in finance and financial services. I was a consultant for over 25 years. Specializing in marketing and management, I provided financial services and consulting services to both the private and the nonprofit sector, board of directors, technical assistants as well. And so here we are today. I am now retired, well, semi-retired. I enjoy supporting Marines, especially veterans of all military services. That's what I've been doing for about 15 to 20 years now.
Well, all you, if you want something done, give it to a busy man, and you're a busy man, so things get done. But let's do a little history. Who were the Montford Point Marines?
The Montford Point Marines were the nation's first African Americans inducted into the Marine Corps in 1942. Before that time, there were no men of color in the ranks of the United States Marine Corps. And of course, upon being inducted, they at 8th and I in Washington, D.C., they were forwarded for training to a camp called, a segregated camp called Camp Montford Point, New River, North Carolina, Camp Lejeune, North Carolina.
And that's where the name comes from, and why it's why I want to bring out this history, because folks go, well, who are the Montford Point Marines? That, is that a city? Where is that? You know, and it's the camp that this first group of African Americans sworn into the Marine Corps were sent off to train down in, I guess it's Jacksonville, North Carolina, is where it's at. So, and this all followed on the heels, if you will, of President Franklin D. Roosevelt's executive order to desegregate the military. It didn't quite work out very smoothly, and certainly these Marines would have faced all kinds of discrimination as they went south for their training, and but ultimately proved themselves up, didn't they?
Absolutely. That is absolutely correct, sir. And they were segregated, although discrimination had been abolished by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, segregation still remained. And of course, in place, if you will, where segregation, bitter racism existed and was very prevalent throughout their training, as well on base as well as off base. So no matter where they went, they were subject to bitter racism and racial segregation. So, yeah.
And I think it's, you know, this is particularly good that the association that you're the head of is keeping this history alive, so that our young Marines and our young people can appreciate that history and see where we've come to and where we need to go. I don't think we could imagine today a Marine Corps that didn't have the valiant service of so many African Americans in it. It's just unimaginable, isn't it?
Very much so. Very much so. It is a different Marine Corps now. As a matter of fact, the Marine Corps professes that the Montford Point Marines, helped establish the Marine Corps and turn it into what it is today, you know, which is an integrated, well-oiled green machine, you know, that picks on all ethnicities and men of color and turns it into the most elite fighting force in the world.
Just to give our listeners some context here, and we're talking to the National Commandant of the Montford Point Marines of America, Robert Middleton. Just to give you some context, listeners, between the seven-year period of 1942 to 1949, more than 20,000 men, this would be African-American men, were trained at Montford Point. So it gives you some idea of the size of the impact that this initial cohort of men coming forward to say, not only I want to serve, but I want to be a Marine, would have on today's Marine Corps. That was kind of recognized, too, the significance of it by the awarding of a Congressional Gold Medal, which is a pretty big deal. Robert, you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yes, of course. In fact, I played an integral role in helping that come about. I collaborated closely with the Marine Corps and the Pentagon to arrange for travel arrangements and lodging for those World War II Black Marines across the United States of America. They were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal by President Barack Obama and the 112th United States Congress in the year 2012. And at that time, there were approximately 450 of those men from all over the United States who had come to Washington, D.C. to participate in that ceremony. And some of them had even checked out of hospice in order to be present for that ceremony on that hot summer day.
Yeah, it is an amazing tribute to a community when it receives the Congressional Gold Medal. Obviously not lightly given out, often given out when there has been historically overlooking the service of various people and communities. And so this goes to the whole Montford Point Marines. That's who gets the, we're awarded the medals. We've had congressional gold medals issued to Nisei, Japanese Americans who were in World War II who got overlooked in a lot of accommodations. There have been other groups like that. But this is must have been a just an incredible day back in 2012 when this was awarded and all your hard work paid off, Robert.
Well, I would say teamwork as opposed to my hard work. We certainly had the cooperation of the United States Marine Corps, various legislators in the United States Congress, including Ms. Corrine Brown, John Boehner, Nancy Pelosi, and numerous others. So it was really a tremendous thing to see in a once-in-a-lifetime situation. One of those unique parts of history, that, and it was really an honor to be a part of.
Yeah, really something. I'm going to read what is the sort of organizational mission for Montford Point Marine Association. But after I'm done with that, I'm going to have you put some bones, flesh on these bones. The association supports educational assistance programs, veterans programs, community services, with an emphasis on improving the social conditions of the growing population of military veterans who are disabled or senior citizens. We almost every organization has a really good mission statement or vision statement. Put some flesh on the bones of that. Tell us what the association is able to accomplish these days.
Well, number one is our mission is to preserve the historical legacy of America's first Black United States Marines. In fact, I wanted to add that since that time of receiving the Congressional Gold Medal, we continue not only to preserve their legacy, but also to seek and identify others who missed the opportunity to receive that award and or their family members and to make the presentation posthumously. And as a result of that, we found a number of those Marines who had not, in fact, received those honors. At our banquet, as a matter of fact, in June, we will be awarding 6 Congressional Gold Medals to designated family members of those first Black United States Marines. So that will certainly be an honor.
Oh, that's incredible that you're still able to find family representatives to reach out to. And as I say, it's a big deal for the community, not just the individual who Marine or family, but it's really a community recognition. So good transition. Let's talk about it. The annual Heritage Military Banquet and Awards Ceremony is coming up on June 23rd. It'll be held at Burden Manor in Livonia. You have a very interesting program. We'll start with telling us, you just told us a little bit about Congressional Gold Medals that will be handed out, but tell us what else is planned for that evening.
Well, we will begin with our program. We have a vocalist that will be singing the Star Spangled Banner for us. We will have a 21-gun salute, posting of colors and taps, award presentations of Congressional Gold Medal, The Centenarian Award. We had one of our Moffett Point Marines is 101 years old. He is one of our remaining approximately 350 to 400 of those first black, original black Marines remaining in the United States.
Wow.
His name is Mr. Butler Martin. Yes, so he will be receiving a special Centenarian Award and the Spirit of Detroit Award. Also, we have a young lady who was the first black transportation designer at the Ford Motor Company. And she, in fact, designed the 1994 Ford Mustang and Thunderbird. She will be receiving the Presidential Lifetime Achievement Gold Medal Award by a gentleman from California named Bill Montgomery, who represents Hidden Pioneers. He will be flying in here to make that award to her. And, of course, our keynote speaker is Major General Cornell Wilson, United States Marine Corps retired, former Director of Manpower and Reserve Affairs.
Okay. Anytime you get a two-star general to show up, it's a big deal. Tell us about General Wilson.
I met General Wilson, as a matter of fact, in 2012, following the presentation of the Congressional Gold Medal. In fact, I met him and his son at the Martin Luther King statue. And so we go all the way back to the year 2012, and we remain friends all these many years. And Cornell Wilson is really an outstanding Marine, at the top of his career, and one of the best in his profession, and he's certainly a credit to the United States Marine Corps, and we honor him.
We're talking to National Commandant Robert Middleton of the Montford Point Marines of America in their upcoming gala on June 23rd. Robert, before we run out of time here, tell folks, hey, this sounds interesting. I should go to this. I should bring my uncle to this. I should bring my grandson to this. How do they find out more about the upcoming banquet and participate?
Absolutely. They can go to our website at www.montfordpointmarinesamerica.org. They can also contact me directly at 313, our headquarters number, 300-0165, and or email me at rmiddleton_@hotmail.com.
Well, we think you'll have a great banquet here. It's clearly a wonderful program. It's keeping the history of these first Marines, African-American Marines who went to Camp Montford Point alive, and I think that's important, as I said, for not only looking back but looking forward. Robert, thank you for some time here on Veterans Radio and for all that you're doing for future Marines as well.
Well, thank you very much. We certainly think that we have a lot to offer all ages, all branches of the United States military. And, of course, we look forward to this event on the 23rd of June. And there also will be entertainment and dancing. We want to add that into the mix as well for those who not only like to come in here, but also like a little activity as well.
So, yeah, and I skipped over. There's undoubtedly food and drink as well. I mean, it's a full banquet.
Yes, yes, it will be, indeed.
Well, again, thanks, Robert, for the time.
You are very welcome. I'm very glad to have been a participant here.
We have a little time, so I'm going to give you a snippet of a podcast that we're doing with Literature of War Foundation, and we're developing a relationship with them to exchange some programs together. Think of Literature of War Foundation as sort of a military book club for units, but here's a snippet of that conversation. So let's turn to this idea of the Literature of War Foundation that you started with an active duty Marine Lieutenant Colonel that you should talk about.
Of course.
But get us started. How did this happen?
teaching there, and those experiences had a profound impact on him. He was working with these young cadets, and they were, you know, talking about literature, specifically war literature, and he started this Instagram account called Literature of War, or Lit of War for short, and he was just posting quotes. It's a little red square with quotes from some texts that had an impact on him, and it took off, right? And that's where he pulled me in, and he said, you know, he's still an active duty Marine, so he had active duty Marine things to do, and he's like, I can't be hanging out on Instagram all day, so why don't you take this over? And it continued to grow, and we ended up incorporating as a 501c3 nonprofit, right, through the IRS, with the idea of how do we take this to the next level, right? Like, how do we have immediate impact on our active duty serving men and women? And all the branches, like, what is the best way to do that? Through literature. We did some book drives. We've done, you know, a couple little things like that, but when we did our book drives, we sent a lot of, probably around 400 books out to various active duty units, and it was great, except we don't know what happened to the books after they were received. You know what I mean? Like, we don't know if they're in a library somewhere, or are they shoved in a closet? We don't know. So we had to go back to the drawing board, and what we came up with is a book club, right? Like, a book club is you sitting down with your teammates, with the people in your platoon, with your friends, and you're reading the same text together, right? And this came about because a pretty motivated staff sergeant reached out to me, a Marine Corps staff sergeant, part of an artillery battery, and he said, I want to do a specific book with my platoon. He wanted to do Matterhorn by Carl Barlantis. And he's like, can you send me just this book instead of like a whole bunch of random books? And at first I was like, it's not really the way we work, but the more I thought about it, I was like, that's actually a really good idea. So I said, how about this? We'll get you 25 copies. We'll get you some notebooks. We'll get you some merchandise from with our logo on it and everything. You guys do the book club on your own, and then we'll meet up with you and we'll talk about what the experience was like. And that created our platoon book club initiative, which has been going for 4 or 5 months now and doing pretty cool things within the community.
Well, it's a really interesting idea because it's a military book club, right? You're operating it here at the platoon level. But it could be shipboard, it could be a department. Now, we all probably have heard about, you know, these 3 and 4-star generals and admirals who have a list of books they recommend you read.
Right.
How is what you're doing different than that?
Right, that's a great question. I mean, those lists are essential, right? Those started coming about in the last couple of decades. And they definitely serve a need. Where we see that we separate ourselves is we're coming at it sort of from outside the community a little bit. Like, I'm out of the Marine Corps. I've got maybe a different perspective. I'm coming from more of an enlisted background, right? Like, a lot of the commandant's reading list, it's coming from a more top to bottom. I like to see this as stuff that maybe these guys wouldn't have been exposed to if they hadn't partaken in this program. You know, it's literature they might not have ever even considered reading if they hadn't gone through this program. You know, we try and meet the needs of the unit. We also ask, like, what do you want to read? Right. So we will take that suggestion as long as it has literary merit and we think they have a reason for wanting to read it. It's not just some random book, but something that can help them bond as a platoon. We're okay with that. And, we also have a curated list, and these are authors that have either done some work recently or ancient classics that we think are of value to the community. So in that way, we're looking to support, like tell us what you need, as well as, like, here's a curated list if you are looking for something to choose from.
It really sounds a little less stuffy to me, if you will.
Those are your words, not mine.
Okay. Yes, you don't want to get in trouble with the generals. I get it. I don't care. But it as you say, you're coming to meet the unit, the platoon, the department where it's at, something right. They're interested in reading. So it's kind of ground up rather than top down, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. And the idea here is that it's not just explicitly military fiction all the time or military poems, or it can be about stuff that at first glance you might think, like, I don't see how this relates to the military or my experience in the military. But then once if you sit there and you read it, you're going to start to see that, like, these experiences that we're listing there are not exactly they're not too far removed than what you're going through. Maybe it's a different time period, maybe it's not exactly a war, but there's something you can get out of there that you can relate to your own experience in serving in the military.
Well, the word literature is going to scare some folks off. They're going to go, I'm not reading the classics. I'm not reading the Greek and Roman classics here. So help us understand what you're talking about in terms of books that have literary merit. Give us some examples of what's on your curated list.
Yeah, of course. We've got, for instance, we just did our first actual debrief session where once the platoon reads their book, right, they get a chance to sit with us on Zoom, because keep in mind these units, they're coming and going. Some of them are halfway across the world. So we sit down on Zoom and we say, like, what do you think of the book? How was the experience? What did you learn from bonding? And like, we just did our first one with Gates of Fire by Stephen Pressfield, which is a novel that came out a couple of decades ago, and it's about the Spartan 300, right? It's about the famous battle where they faced off against insurmountable odds. You know, they were completely outnumbered and they held against them for a prolonged period of time. Now, these were probably 19, 20, 21-year-old infantry Marines in Okinawa, and they were looking at this, and so it was interesting. The group was a little divided, right? Some of them were like, this was amazing. There's a lot of action in it, right? There's a lot of combat, ancient combat, while like the other half of the room was like, this has no bearing on anything I'm doing here. Like, I'm serving in the 21st century Marine Corps.
An interesting discussion with the co-founders of Literature of War Foundation. If you want to hear more of it, check it out on our podcast. We post every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. This one we posted back in late May, so you can find it there. But that's what we do here on Veterans Radio. We bring you interesting stories you're not going to hear anywhere else. Maybe something you want to dig a little deeper on. We get to update you on some history like Montford Point Marines. But we also talk about the future, like in drone technology, and certainly what's happening with the troops today in a military book club. So we're really happy to be able to bring you this kind of information. I'm Jim Fossone, one of the Veteran Radio hosts. Dale Thronberry will be back next week. And you can always check us out, as I say, on Facebook or veteransradio.org. You should also thank our sponsors when you get an opportunity. NVBDC, the National Vietnam Veterans of America, the Vietnam Veterans of America Charles S. Kettles Chapter 310 in Ann Arbor, the VFW Graft O'Hara Post 423 in Ann Arbor, and the American Legion Post 46 in Ann Arbor. So help us out. Keep this mission going. And until next week, you are dismissed.